We're off to the races, powered by The Racing Biz, your independent voice for Mid-Atlantic racing and breeding. On the web at www.theracingbiz.com. And on the radio every Saturday morning, it's Off to the Races. Here's your host.
Hey, good morning, everybody, and welcome to Off to the Races Radio, powered by The Racing Biz. Thanks so much for spending a little bit of your Saturday morning with us. We do appreciate it. My name's Frank Vespi, and for the next 60 minutes, we're going to be talking thoroughbred racing and breeding in Maryland, across the Mid-Atlantic, and around the country. Our show, powered by The Racing Biz, theracingbiz.com. You got the socials. Find us on, you know, Facebook, Twitter, wherever. We're at The Racing Biz. We also got a free mobile app. Pick up the free mobile app for your Apple and Android devices, and you'll never be out of touch with what's going on in Mid-Atlantic racing and breeding. We got a lot to do. I mean, seriously, like a lot. Okay, so first off, you're going to want to stick around to the end of the show, because towards the end, last 20 minutes or so, going to have an interview with the great Ron Turcotte, Hall of Fame jockey, best known for riding Secretariat to Triple Crown glory. Ronnie went into the National Racing Hall of Fame in 1979, still going strong. Going to want to hear what he has to say. Good stuff. Looking forward to that very much. At the bottom of this hour, in the 10:30 or so time frame, going to visit with Nick Dilladivico, a young trainer who's really hit the ground running at Old Hilltop. Just a couple of minutes, we're going to have a conversation. This is going to be interesting. I think you're going to enjoy this. A conversation with former Maryland Racing Commission Chairman Bruce Quaid for his take on the future here in Maryland. Speaking of the future, I want to give a shout out and thanks to a couple of our program supporters, including the Maryland Horse Breeders Association, Wanamakers, wanamakers.com, online horse auction site, True Valor, the stallion standing at Northview Stallion Station, and Richard Hackerman, attorney at law. Now, before we get into today's interviews, a couple of highlights from the last week or so of racing. First off, last night's Grade 2 Penn Mile went to favored Major Dude with Irad Ortiz Jr. up for trainer Todd Pletcher. It was the three-year-old's third graded stakes victory.
Major Dude says, I'm not done yet. He's going to swing up on the far outside. Three quarters, 111.19, and they're into the stretch. Behind enemy lines, the leader. Major Dude needs to do better. Recruiter is down toward the inside. Behind enemy lines, Major Dude runs at him. Major Dude, how good is he? Major Dude behind enemy lines. Major Dude and Irad Ortiz do it in the Penn Mile.
Larry Colmus on the call there. The Penn Mile, the highlight of the Penn National racing season, took place last night. Major Dude gets the money. Major Dude, number 5 on Nick's Turf 10 list of the top turf 3-year-olds in the country. And he was the highest rated on the Turf 10 in the Penn Mile. And in fact, the two rated horses finished 1-2. So Nick Hahn is right on top of it when it comes to rating the turfing 3-year-olds. Now, a week ago today was the first stake at Delaware Park, and in last Saturday's Obea Stakes, that's the local prep for the Delaware Handicap, Award Wanted sprung an 18-1 shocker with Angel Cruz in the irons for trainer Jerry Robb.
And Award Wanted's 18-1. Morning Matcher continues to give game chase, and they're into the stretch. Award Wanted has slipped away to a 2-length lead. Morning Matcher trying to bridge that divide ever so slowly, but Award Wanted is bringing her A game to the table today. Morning Matcher getting on track in the final 16th of a mile. Award Wanted drifting. Morning Matcher lifting late. Award Wanted.
Award Wanted springs the big upset there for trainer Jerry Robb. Josh Brown on the call. Asked after the race if they would head on to the Grade 2 Delaware Handicap for the next start for Award Wanted. Robb was noncommittal. He said, we'll take a look at it. But Robb's a guy who likes to win, so they're going to show up where this horse fits best, whether that's there or someplace else. So let us move on to the program at hand. As I said, Ron Turcotte coming up quite a bit later in the show. Nick Dilladivico at the bottom of the hour. First guest here, want to bring in Bruce Quaid. Bruce was chairman of the Maryland Racing Commission during a particularly consequential period that saw the creation of the so-called 10-year deal to govern racing, the enactment of new breeder and owner bonuses, tougher drug rules, and more. And I reached out to him to ask him to kind of break out his crystal ball for Maryland Racing's future. We're at kind of an inflection point, I think, although I'm going to ask him that question too. So let's hear this interview with Bruce Quaid. Bruce, good morning. Welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us on Off to the Races. I wanted to bring you on today because 10 years ago you were part of putting the 10-year deal together. That was at a real inflection point for Maryland Racing. And I feel like we're at another inflection point with the 10-year deal having expired and short-term extensions and the creation of a racetrack operating authority and what's the future going to look like and where is the future going to take place. But let me start with this. Do you agree with the premise? Are we at sort of an inflection point for Maryland Racing?
Yes, absolutely, Frank. And I think it's one of those deals that the 10-year deal is, as you said, was sort of the basis for things for a long time. And I think it's the linchpin of what's going on now. And I believe that the continuation of that is key because it sets a baseline and it sets a ability to move forward and think about how things are going and where they're going. And so I hope that the parties are successful in coming to an agreement, and even short term, but anything to keep things going. Because when you look at racing right now, just the small part of the day-to-day stuff, it's good. The trainers are doing okay. The purses are good. The owners are doing okay. People are if you just put a bubble around the day-to-day racing, people are making money. So, and that's the basis of the 10-year deal.
Why was it so important to you at that time to get a deal that was as long as that?
Well, because at the time, and it's been long, people don't remember this, but at the time we were talking about cutting racing days down to 40 or 60 days. And it was a real possibility that racing days were going to be decreased dramatically. And there's a certain cost model in racing where you have to have enough money flowing through the system, so to speak. The traders have to have a certain day rate. The purses have to be a certain amount. The track has to make money. And in order to do that, you have to have some number of racing days. And 40 or 60 days would not have allowed that cost model to succeed. And so the fact that we got a 10-year deal where we moved money around a little bit and tried to smooth out the losses and things like that, I think was the key of the 10-year deal. And I think the proof is in the pudding. The 10-year deal ran 10 years, and there was people saying, well, it's not going to last that long, but look how long it's lasted. There's been adjustments to it, but it was a pretty good thing that sort of guided racing for a long time. Annapolis and the state, of course, liked it because it liked the stability that racing had because there was a long-standing agreement, and I believe that's still the case. I think that having a 10-year deal or having a deal sends a good message to the outside world that racing is at least has a certain amount of stability.
It's going to be here 10 years anyway, right? So let's kind of turn our attention to the future here. And, you know, you and I were talking earlier. There's some things we know about the future in Maryland, at least we think we know, or at least we know for the moment. And then a lot of things we really don't know. But the things that we think we know are economics really push the idea that Maryland Racing kind of has to consolidate at one main track, perhaps supplemented with a training center. Politics really pushes the idea that that track needs to be Pimlico to keep the Preakness in Baltimore. Beyond that, there's a lot of stuff we don't know. So I guess I kind of open the field here to you, Bruce. What do you think needs to happen in the future?
I think going back to what I was just saying a second ago, when you look at number of racing days, I think that wherever you have your racing, whether it be all at Pimlico or combination Laurel and Pimlico or Pimlico and some other place, I think there has to be a design such that this cost model that we were talking about a second ago still works. And one of the things that we did back in the 10-year deal a long time ago, I believe it was 145, 150 days then, and it's probably 170 now. I don't see racing in Maryland being able to continue to support that number of racing days. I think because of what's happened nationally with the decrease in horse population, the betting handle decreases, things like that, there's just not enough commodity to support a large the existing number of racing days in Maryland. And I think there needs to be some innovative thought on how horsemen can have a number of racing days available to them, not just racing days in Maryland, but racing days anywhere. So if you're a trainer, instead of running your 170 days in Maryland, maybe you run X in Maryland, and yet you're able to run some of those days in other tracks. And while you're running at those other tracks, you still are able to collect your breeding bonuses and your owner bonuses and things like that. I just don't see the future being able to support the number of racing days in Maryland. And I believe that who's ever in charge, the authority or whatever, should be looking at things where we could partner with other tracks and other states such that there's a number of racing opportunities for people, not necessarily in the state, but again, the cost model viable. As far as Pimlico versus Laurel, I mean, that's certainly changed since the 10-year deal. Back then we were talking about Laurel being the epicenter and Pimlico being the sort of the subsidiary. Now that's completely changed. Bowie's out of the picture. I agree with you. What I believe that the prevailing winds are that racing is going to be at Pimlico. The Preakness is going to be at Pimlico, and it'll be interesting to see what the future of Laurel is. I don't know. I don't know if that answers your question or whether that was.
We're talking with Bruce Quaid here, former chairman of the Maryland Racing Commission, and avid bettor. Did you have the Preakness winner?
Actually, for once, I did. I'm glad you asked me that question. usually, I've talked to you before, and I've always said no. This one I actually did. I don't know how I stumbled on to it, but I did have the winner and won a couple of bucks. I spend all my time now giving bad handicapping advice to my grandson, Connor, and his buddies at James Madison, you know. but in that particular case, I was a big hero because I told him who I thought was going to win. So anyway, yes, so I had it.
National Treasure wins the Preakness. Bruce Quaid has it. I was texting with somebody. I got a text from a friend the morning of the Preakness asking who I liked, and I gave out the winner in a bunch of different sort of media. And I forgot to text him back. So the next morning I texted, would it be too late to tell you National Treasure? So I didn't score any points there.
I know in the past you've texted out multiple winners. So at least some of the people that you've that you're counting to are successful. So if you
count every horse in the race, one of them's got to win, right?
There you go. There you go.
So back to the topic at hand here, the future of Maryland racing. We've got this kind of racetrack operating authority that the legislature created, which is imbued with potentially enormous authority, currently no money, which makes it sort of an interesting beast. But we also have a racing commission, and then we have a separate track operator. We've got the First Racing, the Maryland Jockey Club, Stronach Group, however you want to style them, who owns the racetracks currently. This feels like, you used the word interesting earlier, and the old sort of curse of may you live in interesting times. These feel like pretty interesting times around Maryland right now.
It's funny. Harking back to when we did the 10-year deal, the commission at that time was pretty active in some of the things that we were doing. In the 10-year deal, sort of the 1A of the 10-year deal was all the breeder bonuses and the owner bonus stuff. And we did the medication things. This, I'm not bragging, I'm just saying this is what the commission did. It was pretty active back then. And it seems as if the current commission is sort of a little bit hands off. I think the whole regulation idea of racing, now you got HISA coming in, you've got I would assume perhaps additional federal oversight in the future. The whole regulatory process sounds like it's going to change in the future, and it's starting out in Maryland.
I wanted to ask you this, Bruce. I mean, one of the things I think that went well during your term was relations with the state political leaders in Annapolis. I think there was a sense there for a few years after the 10-year deal came into being that Maryland was really kind of a state on the move in the racing industry, and things were happening, and there was a feeling that Annapolis was very pleased with it. And I don't know that they're very pleased with racing right now, because 3 years ago they authorized the issuance of almost $400 million worth of bonds to renovate two racetracks, and there has yet to be a shovel in the ground. What is the message you feel like, what message does racing need to deliver to Annapolis going forward to ensure continued state support and perhaps even enhanced state support for the things racing's going to need to get itself on track?
It's a very good question. I think that the answer is racing needs a plan. It needs a chart, like a chart on a ship or something. It needs some kind of a plan that spells out, and not 50, 60 page reports, whatever, but something short and sweet that people can understand, that says this is what the future of racing is going to look like. These are the steps that need to be taken. And I think that's severely lacking. I don't think that there's any one entity that's can clearly state where we're going with racing. I mean, there's money to be had. There's a new authority about to happen. There's discussion about future track ownership and whatever. But there's nobody that just is laying out what is the desired course of action and what should be done. I think when you do a plan, part of the plan would be to clearly state where we are now. Like, the plan starts off, this is the status of where we are now, and the next step is, where are we going? And I think that's what's lacking in Maryland right now, is that plan. And hopefully that comes about with the authority, but it's pretty darn frustrating to see all of these things going on. As you said, money has been laying there for how many years, and not a shovel to be Doug, and I understand that. There's going to be a time when somebody in Annapolis says, okay, you have this money, what are you doing with it? And you better do something with it, or we're not going to give it to you, or we're certainly not going to give you any more. And so I think racing ought to get its act together real quick with a comprehensive plan and a clearly stated direction of where it wants to be, you know, and do that sooner than later.
All right. Now, I love this idea that you just came up with or just referenced here of racing having a comprehensive plan, a way to show the public and to show the political leadership, this is where we're going. This is the future. We've talked about some of the things that you think might be elements of the plan, but just to recap, what are some of the things you would see being in that plan, Bruce?
Well, as we both said, you know, this idea of a circuit and being able to race for bonuses out of state and just a cooperative effort with some of the surrounding venues. We're in competition for horse population and handle, and it's important that we recognize that the commodity is reduced. And so in a plan, you have to start off with that premise that I believe there needs to be more of a sharing type consideration. In the past, it's always been every man for himself. And I believe if you had it as a circuit and you worked with the other venues around the area, I believe that's an important thing. The bonus structure is really crucial to the success of the breeding and the owner programs. I believe that you could work it out so you still receive bonuses out of state and make it attractive to people to still own and breed horses to a certain extent. You have all of these different things like different state certifications. The money's there. The money with slots, that's another thing that's changed dramatically since we first started doing this. There's a lot of money, slot money, and purses are high. So I believe there's a good story to tell when you're making this plan. You know, it's not just all gloom and doom. Certainly there's challenges in Maryland and challenges in the national industry, but I think there's a lot of positive things, and I think when you're developing a plan, those things can be explained and expounded upon. I think there needs to be in the plan, I'd like to see something that talked about how you could address some increased attendance at the track. I think you have to sell racing. It's in dramatic competition with the other ways to gamble, but I think if you had, you know, boutique days at the tracks, increased stakes program, you could get people to come out to the track and see what all of the nice things that we saw about racing when we started. And I think there needs to be in this plan some kind of a description on what the who's ever in charge would do about popularizing the sport and increasing attendance and whatever. So I think all of those things, they're not just candy. I think they're things that really need to be done. And I think everybody would understand. I think Annapolis certainly would appreciate that racing. And as I used to say, when I testified down there, racing has its act together. And I think this plan would clearly demonstrate that. And I hope that people consider coming up with this idea so racing can really speak as one.
One racetrack, fewer days, comprehensive plan, portable bonuses. Are those things in Maryland racing's future? Maybe so. Bruce Quaid, thanks so much for joining us here on Off to the Races to help us take a look into the future. Thanks for bringing your crystal ball.
Thank you very much, Frank.
Interesting conversation there from Bruce Quaid, former chairman of the Maryland Racing Commission. The future of Maryland racing, what it's going to look like, how it's going to operate, who's going to operate it, where it's going to operate it. A lot of questions going to be answered over the next several months to a year or two. A lot of things going on in Maryland right now. Interesting to get the perspective of the former commission chairman. Well, we got a little break in the action. I do want to say racing today and tomorrow. I got racing at Pimlico, closing weekend at Pimlico today and tomorrow, Saturday, Sunday, last 2 days of the current meet at Pimlico. And notably, pay attention, may have a pick six carryover into the final day of racing at Pimlico. If it does get there, it's going to be ballpark $500,000 carryover, going to be a lot more wagered into that on Sunday if it reaches there, because Sunday is a mandatory payout day. So might want to keep an eye on that. Might be a little free money lying around somewhere. Might be a chance to get in on some of that action. Also today, racing at Delaware Park, and today racing at Charlestown Races. Fancy Buckle Stakes is this evening at Charlestown. Should be a pretty fun race. Our Charlestown correspondent Ted Black says it should be a good one, so we'll look forward to checking that out at CT. So Pimlico, Delaware, Charlestown, all racing today. Pimlico closing the meet tomorrow. Now, still ahead, going to close up the show with a taped interview from Nick Hahn with Ronnie Turcotte, the Hall of Fame rider of Secretariat. Right now, I want to turn our attention to Nick Della DeVico. Nick is a 32-year-old trainer. His father, Damon Della DeVico, probably familiar to some of our listeners, longtime Maryland-based trainer, has won the DeFrancis Dash a couple times, a bunch of other stakes on his resume. And Nick had been working as Damon's assistant, and more recently moved over to the barn of Lynn Cash, and now Lynn's got days. So Nick is the trainer of record, and he's gotten off to a pretty fast start. Seems like he may have learned his lessons pretty well. Let's bring in our interview with Nick Della DeVico. All right, Nick, thank you for joining us. Good morning. Welcome to Off to the Races. Pretty quick start. You won with four of your first nine starters, I believe, as a trainer of record, which is kind of how you'd like to start off as a trainer of record.
Yeah, it's the best way you can start off as a trainer of record. I think, especially in this country, win percentage matters a lot. And, you know, the lion's share of the purse goes to the winners. You can always make an excuse for a horse, and a pretty good excuse, when they run fifth and sixth and they've made a really good effort. And I think that's part of, you know, learning how to deal with the sport too, because you can go on long stints where horses are running well, but the results aren't coming in like you would hope. And, you know, there's frustrated owners, you start to doubt yourself a little bit, but you really couldn't ask for a better start. And I'm actually even though this interview is me, but the situation I stepped into, the people that are working underneath me right now, you know, took me into their arms and have really kind of performed at a level that I'm really surprised, because I set a high bar.
Well, let's talk about the situation you stepped into. You're training horses for Lynn Cash's Built Right Stables. He had been the trainer of record in general for his own horses, although he has a somewhat far-flung operation with horses here and in Kentucky, and he'll go anywhere with a horse to run. Yeah. A horse. He'll go to West Virginia, Louisiana, yeah, wherever he can find a spot.
And loves action.
Yeah. No, it's clear from the way he handles the stable. And, I mean, he has Beverly Park, who made 30 starts last year. So
beast.
He likes to run them. But talk about how this relationship came to be. You were working for your mom and dad in the barn, and now you're here.
He moved into Maryland, and I remember seeing him in the program a little bit, and I was kind of curious who this Norman Cash guy was, despite the fact he goes by Lynn, and that's what I call him. Moved in the barn, had a guy working for him, and they were finding a little bit of success, but my mom kept like elbowing me and saying, you know, you could move into that situation, you could really do well. And that was almost a year ago, and it stuck in my head. And just recently, maybe a month and a half ago, the assistant trainer ran into some rough times, made some poor decisions, and it left the door open, and I got Mr. Cash's number, and I called him, and I said, without being disrespectful to anybody, that I truly thought that with the quality of horses that he has in the barn, the money that, you know, he invests in the game, that I think that he could get better results. and we spoke for a little bit. We had a really nice lunch at the Red Hot and Blue on Main Street Laurel, and we really kicked it off.
They are not one of our advertisers.
They should be.
So we have nothing to say about them beyond that.
And we just kicked it off. I think I kind of have two sides of me. One side, I'm very much into the horses. Like, I love being hands-on. I'm like really passionate about horses in general. Like, they're my friends. But on the other side, I really enjoy the statistics and the data that's behind horse racing, and just that common ground, the stats. Like, we really hit it off. And, you know, even last night, we almost talked for an hour about stats and different horses. And it's just been, so far, it's been a really good relationship. I think we work really well together.
Now, your father, Damon, is a longtime trainer. He's a two-time winner of the DeFrancis Dash with Lakai and Immortalize.
Track record holder at Charlestown for 4.5.
Immortalize, was one of the, when he won the DeFrancis, that was
beautiful.
Such a cool moment with Bobby Abbo.
I was at Rosecroft. I was at Rosecroft. The horse might have been 10 or 20 to 1.
Yeah,
and
he was
I remember my best friend from high school was, we were trying to get him a job at Rosecroft, which is a standardbred track, if anybody doesn't know. And we're over there, and I gave him $100 because I was actually working at the time, and I was like, you need to run downstairs, and you need to bet Immortalize in this race. And I ended up winning the race and cashing the check. But just being proud of Dad, because, you know, I think that Mr. Albo was kind of a demanding person, and he was the owner of that horse, and I think that because that horse was starting to get older in age, there was always like that latent pressure to, you know, retire horses like that. And my dad has a really strong belief that, you know, when you give them time and you're really patient, you know, these horses can really perform and run huge and run super competitive numbers, super competitive times if given the time.
Which he ran huge that
yes,
day.
He did.
Your father, the work he did with Immortal was really a fantastic job.
He won like 28 races, I think.
Yeah, he won over $1 million.
He would close at Charlestown going 4.5 at 8 lengths out, which is really impressive.
It's
really
almost impossible to do at 4.5.
Now, Jorge Navarro almost beat the track record before the whole stint when he got in trouble with the Federales.
So it was
very close.
But what I wanted to ask is, so your father Damon's been a trainer of record for a long time. Your mother Chris works in the barn with Damon. They've been a team for a long time. But you didn't really, you were not a barn rat as a kid. It was more later in life that you came to racing. Talk about how that came about.
So my parents wanted me to stay away from the racetrack. I think to them, having a really good education and going to school, being more involved in sports would be a better option for me, even though I got in trouble constantly in middle school and high school. I just couldn't shut my mouth. But, you know, on the weekends, I would come to Bowie because my dad had horses at Bowie before they closed down that facility. By the way, never lost the racetrack. Great spot. And I just have this very nostalgic feeling, you know, of just kind of the smell of the racetrack, you know, Saturdays and Sunday mornings. And I don't know how that happened because I was into a lot of different things. You know, I played college soccer. I really thought my life would kind of go in a different direction. But I think because of the amount of work that my dad did to kind of like help secure my family, and I idolized that, and, you know, my mother's worth ethic, it kind of kept drawing me back. And I got to dealing with horses. You know, it took me, my mother did not let me touch a horse. I've worked in the barn and I hot walked for a full year before I ever was able to go into a stall with the horse. She was very rigid and very demanding on that side of things. But once I got in the stall and I started rubbing on horses, you know, I really kind of got, I was moved by them as animals and as, you know, their own thing. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, they have their own personalities. They're very loving. Some of them don't like you. Some of them, you know, do anything, and they all come out here and they do this sport, and it's kind of, it's moving in a lot of ways. You know, when you see, like, you know, I cried when Lakai won the DeFrancis Dash because it just meant so, not just like what it meant to us in the barn, but because of like his effort in the event. You know what I'm, it's just,
no,
it's hard to put in words the companionship and the connection that you can have with a racehorse.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. And I've often thought, I mean, one of the things that racing has not done well is it's sort of like it appeals to, you know, certain bettors, yeah, of which I am one. It appeals
me
to
too, sometimes
certain horse lovers. But what racing has sort of missed is, like, it lives at the intersection of humans and horses. And, like, the thing you, I think you're talking about is you honor what they give.
Absolutely.
Which is so much of what they have. And like, if there's a way to bottle that and show it to people, I think a lot of, you know, PETA or whatever, the groups that are anti-horse racing, be like, oh, I didn't quite understand that.
You know, it's funny because I had the opportunity. So, like, mom always loved horses. You know, my dad has a really good hand with horses. And some people definitely have a special touch. But I've met some, like, really good grooms. One guy, his name was Tommy Lee Edwards. He was out of Louisiana. I met him when I worked for Tom Morley. And he loved hugging horses. As silly as that might sound, I'm, you know, like, and you could kind of see that connection. And his horses always ran really well for him. And I think that, you know, we're always, some of the best stories in life aren't always, you know, at the Breeders' Cup and stuff like that. Some of these horses that exist on the backside at Pimlico or maybe at Hawthorne, you know, they mean a lot to people. And just because of that connection, like, if you're having a bad day and you want to go talk to a horse, you know, you're going to have a good conversation. He or she might not say much back. But however, just by paying attention to them and stuff like that, you're going to have a really strong connection, to the point where, you know, after working, even if it's your first time working for a month, I've had tons of people that have very little experience. They jump in. Within a month, they're telling me how this horse feels. Like, ah, he's having a bad day. And you're like, oh, well, that was interesting, because you didn't think they could have bad days a month ago.
Right.
You know, and so that's, you know, and to bottle that up, like you said, and to present it to the public, I think is really hard, because you have to experience it. It's like having a family dog. You know, Dad was talking to me not too long ago. We try to run our horses aggressively and we try to win races. And we're just having, I don't, for lack of better words, a heart to heart. And we're like, you know, these guys want us to win races, and we do. But they also want us to sacrifice a lot of family events, vacations, holidays in order to be there for the horses all the time. And then they ask us to sell them or to run them aggressively. And not to get on the touchy subject of claiming, because I think it serves a really good purpose. And we've made and done super well. I think my dad's made his career on claiming for mm-hmm. the most part. But it does feel like you lose a family member when a horse leaves the barn. Even if they're retired and they go to a good life, you're losing a family member, someone that you've taken care of and been with for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Talking with trainer Nick Dilla DeVico here. Nick, I did want to ask you this. So, and we're going to have to let you go shortly, but you've been an assistant trainer. You're working with your folks. You worked with Tom Morley, with Kent Sweezy. Now you're the guy. What has surprised you about that experience?
What has surprised me the most about the experience is how much people are willing to do for you if you include them in the process. If you win a race and you walk up to the farrier or even the veterinarian that might have helped you with, like, a bad eye a couple weeks ago, and you high-five them, the first thing they say is, like, what happened? And you're like, we won. That horse that, you know, he was sick a couple weeks ago, you know, we caught it, we did really well with it, and now we won. You know, you're part of it. And they look at you and they're like, that's you. And you're like, no, it's not. It's everybody. Uh-huh. And to me, it's the surprising part is that people don't really feel necessarily involved in it, but they're working with the horses all the time. And, you know, when it comes down to it, by the time the horse makes a start as a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old, the horse has been touched by so many people. And it kind of made me think a little bit bigger picture that, and I always try to do it in my dad's barn, you know, I try to say a thank you text to whoever bought the horse, you know, whoever broke the horse, if I know that. I try to send a photo to the breeder. because, you know, that is also what's missing a little bit in horse racing too. I think, you know, even thanking the, you know, the state veterinarians, and not like in a really cheeky way, but like, you know, they help facilitate this whole sport. You know, my wife is a state veterinarian. You know, I talk to her all the time about like where it's going and like what is coming next. And, you know, the most successful horse that I've trained, even though it was my dad, it was under my father, his name was Ten Eyck, and I ran him two times. Tom Morley sent the horse to me, and the horse won cheap. And I remember my wife told me one time, she goes, you know, this horse really, he's a little tiny horse. He looks like he wants to go a mile and a half. And I was like, well, babe, why did you say that? And she goes, it's just the way he looks, you know. And I ran him a mile and a half, and he just got beat, ran second, and he got beat by a filly that's going to end up winning two or three stakes after that. You know what I mean? So, like, you can't, you got to consider everybody that's involved, and you can't get too focused on yourself, because it's a team. It's a big team. You know, if I couldn't count on the people to get the horses out, to take care of the work, I would be dead in the water today, and you wouldn't be talking to me.
Good enough. Well, all right, Nick DeLodovico, we're going to let you go. Thanks so much for spending some time with us, and good luck today.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Frank.
From a young man just starting his career, let's kind of spin to the other end of the spectrum with a taped interview from Nick Hahn with Ron Turcott here. Ron Turcott, the legendary Hall of Fame rider of Secretariat. He also rode Riva Ridge. Turcott went into the Hall of Fame in 1979. You know, you look at the numbers, he won about 15% of his starts. He won 3,000 races. They're good, but they don't quite tell the story. This might give you a better idea. Here's a list of some of the Hall of Famers that Turcott piloted. Damascus, Northern Dancer, Fort Marcy, Arts and Letters, Shuvi, Dahlia, Dark Mirage. He also, of course, Secretariat, of course, Riva Ridge. And he also won the Preakness in 1965 with Tom Rolfe. So really one of the most impressive resumes of any rider, particularly a rider who had a career that was just 18 years long as his was. Always an honor to have the great Ron Turcott on Off to the Races Radio. Let's give a listen to Nick's interview.
Oh, I'm doing all right. Not good enough to travel, but I'm doing all right.
That's great to hear. You've been so gracious with your time on our show, Off to the Races, over the years, especially on Belmont Stakes Day, or as Belmont Stakes Day approaches. This being the 50th anniversary, how is this one, especially in regard to media attention, been different for you?
Well, I'm awful busy this week, all week, from a different interview from different places. They had celebrated in town here. It don't seem that long to me.
What do you remember about the 3 weeks between the Preakness and the Belmont Stakes?
Penny, a little more, put Penny on edge a little bit, and Lucian maybe. I don't know, me, I was getting on the horse. I was working him and all his workout like I did throughout the Triple Crown, and I was very confident I was going to win, and we just passed the Preakness, and he just galloped there and came out good out of the race. And I wasn't thinking about it. It was just nice to see him on all them covers.
Certainly just a phenomenal time in horse racing and nationally. One of the other items that I discovered was the Kurt Gowdy show, The Way It Was. And in the show, you are being interviewed alongside Eddie Arcaro, who rode Citation to his Triple Crown. And I want to play just a clip from the show.
Of course, you would be the best to answer because you rode Citation and you saw Secretariat. In your opinion, if they were both three-year-olds, every condition the same, and we put them on the track together, who would have won?
I don't think you can answer that, Kurt, and be knowledgeable about it. I mean, that's great barroom talk. You know, you can argue forever who was the best. Longdon is a very good friend of mine. He tells me Count Fleet was the greatest. Shoemaker tells me Swaps was the greatest. Ron is going to tell you that Secretariat was the greatest, and I'm going to tell you Citation was the greatest. So that you could, that's a matter of opinion. I will say this, though. I don't think that any horse could have beaten Secretariat in the on Belmont Day. I've never seen a horse do the things that he did that day.
It must be pretty satisfying to have Eddie Arcaro say that Secretariat could not have been beaten by any horse on that Belmont Stakes Day.
Yeah, it was very satisfying. He was there throughout the three races. Eddie Arcaro, I spoke with him before going to the jockey's room in Kentucky, and so I knew that he had seen the three races personally, and he really thought very high of Secretariat, but he didn't want to say anything because he was friends with the Joneses and didn't want to insult them.
One of the things I saw in the movie, the Canadian-made movie, they show you with Jean Cruguet. Do you talk to him in French or do you talk to him in English?
Well, he's hard to understand. Either in French, his French, and my French is not the same. And same thing in English.
Do you get a chance to talk to many of the jockeys, either of this era or the era when you rode?
Oh, yes, I do. I do. I spoke a lot with Eddie Arcaro. Like, you know, when we were there taping there we stayed in the same room at the hotel. We've spoken a lot. And like I said, he was there to see the race, and we had breakfast together before I went to the jockey's room.
This is in regard to Reaver Ridge, who won two Triple Crown races in 1972 before Secretariat. How important was Reaver Ridge in terms of the eventuality of Secretariat winning the Triple Crown?
Well, I'll tell you where he was very, very, how should I say that? Without him, we might not have, Meadow Stable might not have been able to keep Secretariat. So he saved the farm. Reaver Ridge saved the farm. And I love him dearly. He was a beautiful horse to ride. And after I got on him, I had four races. I was beaten twice and won two races. And after I got on him, he went the rest of the year without a defeat and became the richest two-year-old in, I think it was at the time. So yeah. He saved the farm.
You were one of 12 children. I didn't realize that until I saw this Canadian-made movie that I really recommend everybody to look at. It just provides such a wonderful background on you and really shows your personality. How was your introduction into racing? Could you have seen yourself doing anything else once you got involved? Other than being a jockey?
I got along real good with horses, and from the time I was 14 years old, I worked with horses in the lumber. So I was, a very thorough horseman. I was really interested in training horses once I retired.
Bill Knack mentions that, talks about how you would have been an excellent trainer. He mentions that in that film, and you can see that in that film. I'd really recommend everybody to take a look at that. What are you looking forward to on Belmont Stakes Day?
Oh, I spend my day pretty well in front of the TV, listening to what they all have to say and watch the race. I think that there's not much speed in the race, so it's probably be the same horse that won the Preakness that will take the lead. And I don't expect to see another horse winning by 31 length and running in 2:24.
He is going to be the Triple Crown winner. Here comes Secretariat to the wire. An unbelievable, an amazing performance. He hits the finish 25 lengths in front.
Well, he was supernatural horse anyway. He was one of a kind. I know for sure. I'll never see one of them come up that good. He was everything. Oh, we got along real good. He was I guess we were the perfect partner.
How critical is it, that partnership between horse and jockey?
Well, it's a good thing for a jockey to get on the horse in the morning for their workouts, getting ready, whether it be the Derby or the Preakness or the Belmont. See, I was working them, River Ridge and Secretariat. I was doing all their workouts before their big races. So, well, matter of fact, you know, before all of their races, I was doing all their workouts. So that gives a jockey an edge when you ride, when it comes to the race. You can't get his horses. They know each other better. They trust you more.
Not including the about 15 or 20 autographs that you've signed for me. How many autographs do you think you've signed in your lifetime?
Oh my God. I couldn't even tell you for one here. More than a million, I'll tell you that for sure.
Absolutely. Well, I thank you for the dozen or so that you did for me. Thank you for being our guest today.
You're welcome.
Always good to hear from Ron Turcotte there. Ron Turcotte, the writer of the Great Secretariat. I wanted to bring in Nick Hahn. Nick conducted this interview by phone with Ronnie, who was at home in New Brunswick, Canada at the time. And Nick, thanks for doing the interview. Thanks for sharing your work with us. And what's it like talking to the Hall of Famer?
Well, the thing that struck me in doing the interview and also with a video that I watched shortly before it, the word that comes to me is courage. This is a guy who, when a lot of people say, I could have ridden Secretariat to the Triple Crown, and Ronnie would even sort of agree with that a little bit. He says it was easy to win the Triple Crown with Secretariat, and he certainly made it look easy. But this is a guy that shows a lot of courage. He could have quit. He has been spending the last 45 years of his life or so in a wheelchair, and he just is so positive about living life and so positive about the sport, and positive in his attitude about how he just is going to live the rest of his life. To me, it just speaks about courage. And there's a thing to be said here with the environment that we live in here in the last month or so in the racing industry, that something needs to be said for opportunity. Because for Ronnie Turcotte, this is a guy that was a lumberjack. He becomes familiar, as you heard in the interview, by pulling logs with horses. That's how he becomes introduced into the horse world. He later goes, I think he said Toronto, he goes to Toronto with $50 in his wallet. He's trying to work any job he can, washing dishes, you name it, and he's about to give up and come home. He has to swallow it up and tells his dad. His dad was a very positive person as well, very hardworking, very blue collar. And the last thing he does before he leaves town is walk horses, and hot walk horses. And eventually that leads to riding, and his career takes off. Now, he had a number of great mounts, and Riva Ridge the year before, he is very sensitive to the point that Riva Ridge was a great horse. He does not want that horse to get lost in Secretariat's shadow, as many do. But you know, the opportunity for him to go from where he was to being the Triple Crown winner, the first one in 25 years, to have the misfortune of an accident that left him paralyzed, and he is still here. He is still as positive. He is as sharp as ever. It was really an honor to talk to the Hall of Famer.
Now, Nick, you just mentioned Riva Ridge as a horse that maybe is lost a little bit to the ages. He won two legs of the Triple Crown, but not the third, and we tend not to remember those horses as well as time goes by. And Ron Turcotte obviously won all three with Secretariat, but then not too many years later was severely injured and left in a wheelchair. Where do you see his career kind of in the racing pantheon?
He won the Preakness before Secretariat with actually a Virginia bred by the name of Ton Rolfe. He rode a number of good horses. He kind of rapidly matured and became a good rider. And you can just look at the mentorship that he has with jockeys that race today or even raced during his era and just see how much respect they have for him. Reva Ridge did not win the Preakness, and that was a concern for them as they went through Secretariat's Triple Crown. He credits, as you heard in the interview, the Reva Ridge with saving the Chenery Farm. It wasn't Secretariat, as you would suspect in the Disney movie. It was actually Reva Ridge. So it's any interview that I've ever done with Ron Turcotte, it's really important for him to acknowledge the accomplishments of Reva Ridge.
Yeah, and he also, interestingly enough, we all, of course, remember Secretariat's Belmont. He told me, and one of the couple of times I've spoken with him, that he thought his Preakness was actually his best race when he made kind of a breathtaking last-to-first move entering the first turn.
Bill Knack would agree with you. He wrote about that in the book and has been in several documentaries. He says that was the greatest move of Secretariat's Triple Crown, was the move in the Preakness, because he basically went from last to first, and that was just something you didn't see early in the race. Horses that try that usually don't fare well late in the race, but it worked out really well, of course, for Secretariat.
Nick Hahn, thanks so much for doing the interview and joining me to talk about it after.
No problem. It was a pleasure.
And just like that, we have reached the end of another week of Off to the Races Radio, powered by the Racing Biz. Thanks so much for spending a little bit of your Saturday with us. We appreciate it. Next time we talk to you, it's going to be June 10. It's going to be the day of the Belmont Stakes, the final jewel in the Triple Crown. So looking forward to the conversations we'll be having next week. Thanks so much to you for listening to our program. Thanks to our show supporters, including Richard Hackerman, attorney at law, the Maryland Horse Breeders Association, True Valor, the stallion standing at Northview Stallion Station, and Wanamaker's Online Horse Auctions. Thanks to all our guests on the show this week, which featured trainer Nick Dilladevico, former Maryland Racing Commission chairman Bruce Quaid, taped interview from Nick Hahn with Ron Turcotte, the great Hall of Fame jockey of Secretariat, and some chat with Nick himself. Keep up with racing and breeding all week long on the Racing Biz, theracingbiz.com. You can tune in next Saturday, 10 a.m. here on Baltimore Positive to hear the independent voice from Mid-Atlantic Racing and Breeding. My name's Frank Vespi. Have a great week, everybody, and we'll see you in the winner's circle.